Welcome to Catalytic Curiosity. I am your host, James with a Y O'Farren with Catalytic Conversations. I serve remote professionals and hybrid organizations with coaching, consulting, and training to help them reconcile humanity and technology, leading to healthier, digitally integrated lives and teams. On this podcast, I am embarking on a journey of discovery to unearth the roots of digital mastery and maturity beyond mere adulting. I interview insightful and intriguing experts exploring how we can develop sage-like maturity with intention in today's digitized world. Today's episode brings John Stopchick to the table to talk about intangibility and tangibility in the digital world. John is a software engineering manager. He's a programmer. He's a gamer. He's a space fanatic. He's a good friend of mine from Toastmasters and our mutual Toastmasters club, Nerdmasters. I'll put a link to that in the show notes for you to take a look at and possibly visit us at a meeting at some point. Also, you can look him up on LinkedIn. You can find a link to his profile in the show notes there as well. During our conversation today, we talk about artificial reality, virtual reality, the generations of tech, and the epic changing ways that humans have interacted all the way from writing until now and the acceleration of change recently with that. We're going to talk about ergonomics. We're going to talk about how to listen to needs and all the ways to manage these changes with maturity and bringing humanity into play in this very different digital world. So welcome aboard and let's get started. Welcome to the Catalytic Curiosity Podcast. And right now I have with me a good friend of mine, John Stopchick, who I got to know through Nerdmasters, which is the better version of Toastmasters. I'll put a link to our site for our club in the show notes so you can know what the inside joke is. So come visit our club and get to know us and all that kind of stuff. But I'm really excited to have John in here today. And we've been nerding out a lot about technology and the digital world and all the changes that have been happening as a result of that. And we're going to be talking about intangibility and tangibility. So John, let's talk and start off with touchscreens and some of the generational stuff that came out of that. What are your thoughts on touchscreens?
I have several thoughts on touchscreens. Believe it or not, even though I'm a software engineer, a programmer, when they first came out, I was not an early adopter. I didn't like them. And it's funny that
you didn't like touch screens, or you didn't like early adopters.
I find myself usually an early adopter, but no, I didn't really care for touch screens. I found them overly engaging at first. The iPod.
Interesting way of putting it.
Well, the iPod had come out. To me, the idea was overwhelming. And on top of that, I started as a web developer. I liked building web pages for computers. And so I had a little bit of resistance. And another thing that irked me was there was this lack of feedback when you use the touchscreen. You tap it, yes, but there's not, where the touchscreens were back then, when you tap the screen, you didn't feel any feedback. You didn't get the vibration your phone has now. Mm-hmm. It's really funny that you and I are talking about this, because in hindsight, that lack of feedback, that lack of, to take your terminology, a lack of tangibility when you tap the screen, it really drove me insane. Drove me insane, maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but
we're nerds, we get it.
it was frustrating. And eventually I couldn't avoid it. One of our clients at my old job, I'd work with cruise companies, and they wanted to make a digital magazine. This iPad had eventually come out and people were buying it everywhere. So suddenly you had the iPhone, the iPad, and it was unavoidable. So I eventually started to learn about programming it and how they work. And in more recent years, because these devices are the same technology we use for virtual reality, I've sort of fallen in love with a lot of that. As a little spoiler, I see that as the next step of a lot of these simple devices, these cell phones. There are means to tap into a deeper world, and yeah. It's the same problem all over again. There's all these little quirks that still need to be adapted.
Yeah.
And I think that plays to this whole topic broader as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the resistance, though, to this new way of interacting is really kind of fundamental to us, because this is how we're relating to our world. And we as humans like to have patterns and work through systems that we're familiar with. And we interact with things, we figure out all these nuanced ways of communicating and interacting. And then when that changes, it's hard to adapt. It's really hard to reconnect in a sense when that happens. And we've been having that happen a lot more lately. So we were talking about history and now this isn't the first time we've had this kind of barrier that's reintroduced. So, I mean, I remember reading about back when there's records, I'm not sure how historically accurate this, whether it's apocryphal or not, but of really early when writing was first invented, when that was the new technology, and there was resistance by the dynastic rulers, like whether it was the pharaohs or whoever it was. We're saying, you know, this is going to, you know, retard people's ability to remember things. Mm-hmm. Just like nowadays, you know, using calculators, like you need to learn to do math in your head because you're not going to carry a calculator with you everywhere, which we, of course we do now. But there's this fear of this new externalization of something that had been more human or more obviously human, possibly.
And I think I've also heard, with the advent of the printing press, there were some people in the aristocracy. Now, again, I don't know the exact details of this, but I've heard that individuals, the rulers, the ruling class, the nobles, didn't want peasants to have access to that, all the information of the world. They
it was a revolutionary thing. It transformed everything. The way we interact with the written word fundamentally changed at that point.
And it's funny because the same pullback response, the same pull from individuals has played, like you said, throughout history, with the record player moving to the radio, with the radio moving to television. Mm-hmm. There are still people who are indignant about TV. There are people who are alive today who remember a time before TV. Well, maybe still alive today who remember a time before television.
Well, and I grew up without a television completely. Right, we just didn't have a television. We watched movies on our computer screen now and then, but it was very selected, and we didn't really listen to the radio, didn't listen to newspaper. We were a very sheltered homeschooled type family, but we listened to a lot of music. Well, music was kind of our main medium that we chose to operate with, but all of the television and all of the changes through that, I just completely missed all of it. It was interesting, culturally speaking.
And now with computers, with the internet, we're all connected. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is, in a lot of ways, this is basically the next evolutionary step, us talking here on the computer visually. Yeah. It's interactive TV to some extent. And there are still people who are super resistant to computers. People in my high school, I went to high school with, I would have conversations with them. They'd say, I don't see why we need these computers. What do they do? And now
it's hard to figure out what do they not do.
exactly. And there's the overlap is everywhere with these
devices. You said something there that I thought was really interesting, is that, you know, these are like interactable TVs. Mm-hmm. And there's like this spectrum of technology making the world more interactable.
Absolutely.
And there's this perception nowadays of the digital world as being less intangible. It's very true. I mean, it's something that's a big, huge struggle for connection, because most of our human history, we've established culture and community connection through physical touch, handshakes, through eating together, and all these swaths of senses, like, you know, 2/3 of our senses that we use to communicate with aren't available for interaction with right now, with what we're doing right here, right?
Exactly. And
yet, so it's like, in a sense, technology has like removed whole swaths of tangibility and interaction. And yet it's at the same time increasing interaction at the same time. So there's this interesting contrast or conflict in a sense.
Well, I also think it's a challenge to be met. It's that as we become disconnected through this technology, we find ways to reconnect.
Yes.
I lost on the fact that I'm really interested in virtual reality. Well,
let's talk about that for a bit.
Yeah. this next iteration of revolution of technology, I think, is going to be VR. I think, like you said it perfectly. You mentioned the handshake. Well, I have over here one of my VR controllers, and I wrap this on my hand, and I can grip someone else's hand when I'm in virtual reality. And we've been finding ways to mitigate where you get a response, you get that feedback, and people crave it. Without it, if you approach a person with two different controllers and say, this one, when you grip, you'll squeeze something in the game or in the virtual world in your chat environment. Mm-hmm. And if someone else grips your hand, you'll feel it vibrate. You'll feel that person's handshake. And then you're presented with an alternative, which is basically just a stick that maybe just does a little vibrate feeling when you try to shake someone's hand. You're going to pick the more human experience. You're going to pick the controller.
More human experience. We're reintroducing more humanity in a sense.
Yes. And this goes back to cell phone design. I mentioned my frustration about the lack of feedback on cell phones and on tablets. And something that I recall watching on the news was these stippling bubble out features of prototypical phones. We don't see that too much now, but what it would actually inflate where the buttons are on the screen in these prototypes. And they were trying to simulate the button push sensation just because that's more comfortable with people.
We need that immediate feedback to know that something happened.
Yeah. And I think the middle ground is what's called a haptic. A haptic is when you touch something and it vibrates or shakes. Whenever you do that, when you're chatting on a messenger, it makes a little click sound as you're typing. That feedback is satisfying to people. Yeah. They want that.
Yeah.
And those feedback mechanisms have been studied. They're especially in the game industry, for example. Those little cell phone games that you play when you download an app from the store and it makes the little jingling sounds, the casino sound effects in your video games, those are the same sensations that we're attacking. We're trying to connect with people. And it's proven that adding these little force feedback sensations, these little sensors, there's a real profit aspect to them. People who make these games will add pay content that you can only get if you give real money to the game. A perfect example is Pokemon Go. Pokemon Go is satisfying when you play it. When you spin on the screen and you throw the Pokeball, it's a simulated real human feeling.
Yeah.
And
it's not how you actually, they're not directly translating it. It's not actually how you throw a ball, but it's almost symbolic.
Yes.
We connect to it that way.
Yep. And it creates these expected feelings in apps. So now, you know, Pokemon has been revolutionary because it's gotten people out into nature, scanning things with the game, catching animals in a virtual environment. And again, that takes us back to VR. These little mechanisms are already translating into virtual reality, into these next levels of experience. And as we progress forward, future generations, to them, it's going to be as fundamental as us clicking a save button is fundamental to us.
The save button that's labeled with a floppy disk.
Exactly. That
don't exist anymore.
and there are children who don't even know that was a real thing, this little disk. And meanwhile, we look at it and we think, oh, 3.5 or 3.25 floppy disk. That's something we grew up with.
Right.
And that disconnect is constant. That disconnect is actually how you drive that development. If it's intuitive to someone who's never seen what the real thing is based on, then you know you've done it right when you've created that interface, that element. And, you know, this is something near and dear to me. Is design.
Ergonomics, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Talk a bit about ergonomics and what the value there is and how important that is to you and how it relates to us, and in particular in connection with game design driving ergonomics innovation.
Well, I think game design and also industry. In games, it's the easiest way to get people to give feedback. Let's take a step back. Ergonomics, the human interaction, the human feeling and experience of using a device. You want it to feel fundamental when you do something on a device.
Right.
With games like Pokemon Go, they've really taken steps forward, as I mentioned. In the industries, in in the professional industries, they tend to be a little bit slower to adopt those things. I think games really push the envelope. Mm-hmm. And I can think of a really great simple example. 3 years ago, I was at a developer conference at a geotechnical software conference. I'm not going to name the company, but they do ground mapping and ground analysis tools.
Okay.
It's really cool stuff. So for example,
like sonar and surveying type stuff?
Surveying, yes.
Okay.
Geographic information.
Okay.
A great example of a tool I saw demoed there was on a cell phone, you could download their app, hold it up over an area of the world and tell it where you are with your coordinates, and it would show the pipes underground. Now, as you moved
around, super helpful.
It is. It's very helpful, but it was also a janky piece of software. It was still prototyped. It was still in development. And you could tell because as you moved your phone, it would skip and stutter, which is really jarring on a phone. But let's take that another step further. In modern day gaming with virtual reality, when that sort of thing happens, you have that up on your face, that kind of thing will make people sick.
Yeah.
Literally motion sick.
Yeah.
And having to compensate for that sort of thing that's at the core of this whole ergonomics. Mm-hmm. Another piece of software at the same conference would let you put on a headset and look at an entire environment and fly around it. And I think this was on an old Gear VR, Samsung's old virtual reality product. And it was cool. But again, when you floated around, the camera access was a little flighty, for lack of better words. It didn't make me feel motion sick. I've only gotten motion sick from VR once.
Okay.
But the experience...
From what I've heard, you're fortunate.
I was very lucky. I've been very lucky, generally speaking.
Particularly with how much you work with VR.
Yes, exactly. I'm in almost every day. And using that software at that conference, when you moved around, it didn't feel right. Now in modern VR
games. And I've heard, correct me if I'm wrong, but part of that is a part of it was the lag, wasn't it? Where you would move and it wouldn't move exactly in sync with you. And there'd be this kind of weird disorientation or be out of sync. And mm-hmm. that's what really threw people off. And which goes back to the issue with, in a larger sense, the buttons on the initial touch screens not providing you feedback that what you're doing is actually having an effect.
Yep.
I'm wondering if that's one of the big things of that tangibility. There's immediate feedback and connection that we have to have with it in order for it to really click with us.
Absolutely.
Unintended.
Well, and the technology has to catch up to some extent. What you're talking about is a limitation of the hardware.
Right. There's only so much it can do.
Exactly. And something more subtle, but on the same note, is frame rate. We watch,
yes,
if you watch old television, it's at about 30 frames a second, maybe 24, mm-hmm. depending on where you are in the world. But that's pretty much on the edge of where we start to see or we'll feel discomfort when we're watching something. Mm-hmm. Again, with the gamers, especially people who do first person shooters, they very often insist on at least 60 frames a second, and in some case running at 120 hertz. Now, we have TVs now that produce these things, which are amazing. I have one upstairs that you watch it at 120 hertz or 120 refreshes of the screen, and everything moves buttery smooth across the screen. Huh. And you don't think about it until you actually use it. And I never even really cared. And that never really bugs me. But a lot of my friends who are getting into virtual reality said, until it's 4K, until it's 120 hertz, I can't do it or I'll get sick.
Hmm.
That to me was mind blowing because it's not just the lag and the disconnecting mm-hmm. from the equipment,
yeah.
but just the nature of how quickly the screen flickering is on your face.
Yeah.
That's a really nuanced thing you can't figure out till later.
I was just watching the trailer or the trailers for Unreal Engine 5, right? And the real time rendering of photorealistic 3D sets, and it was at the scale it was like a Matrix film where they took the models of Neo and Trinity with their generated one, and we're going through the city and doing all this stuff with, you know, gunfights and car crashes and lights and through the whole city, and it was all rendered in real time.
Oh my goodness. Yeah,
that was photorealistic.
It's not just a recording, but no. It's actually the 3D
activity is interactive. That is so cool. With the physics engines and the lighting that was dynamic and interact with everything. The destruction was dynamic, interact with everything. And they're talking through the technology of what they've actually done. It's like they've evidently, and I still have no clue how this is possible, but they said that they had fundamentally redesigned how ray tracing worked to get the light to work right in real time. So you're losing the processing power. And then they reduced the dependence. Basically, they allowed for infinite polygons.
Oh, okay.
So that, because you know how the more polygons you have in a scene, the more stress it's going to put on your computer, right?
Yeah.
They said that doesn't apply anymore. I'm like, okay. By what magic was there?
How do you have such a limitation? Absolutely.
But it was like, you know, this is the first time they've ever like actually rendered chain link fence instead of just a picture. Because they actually have the whole thing. Like they have millions of entities with millions of polygons with millions of resources on this whole thing and doing it in photorealistic thing. Like this is like the next gen thing. I'm thinking, I was watching this, I was thinking back to our conversations in preparation for this talk, like VR. this is what we need to do this.
Well, and you bring up chain link fences. Anyone who's ever gamed, they see it, you'll see it just, there's translucency. There's always like little factors you got to consider when rendering that stuff. And you end up,
it's always messy.
Flat screen. Yeah, there's always something off. And it's funny you mentioned that, because one of my favorite parts of jumping in VR last year during all of us being in lockdown, I was playing this one game where I was completely stunned, because as I walked around a room, I had a light, and as I shone that light across the different parts of the room, I ran my hand across a fence. And it's funny you mentioned that specifically, because as I moved my hand around, the shadow of the fence would move all over the place.
Oh, wow.
And that interaction for me, I had to just stop and just play around with it for a few minutes, because if you've ever been a gamer, and you've seen these fences in games, it's that level of interaction and detail is mind blowing. We didn't have that for the longest time. And now that we do, it feels more natural. And now when I go back into that same game, I can see creatures jumping across the shadows, and that interaction actually provides to the experience of being immersive, of you not realizing you're in a virtual world. And that's the ultimate goal, is
right.
to make it so when someone's using a device, they're not thinking about the device, they're thinking about their objective on the device.
Right. That's the thing that I always say, is that technology is supposed to be an extension of humanity.
Right.
Right. It's not supposed to be antagonistic toward this. It's supposed to be extend and multiply what we already are in that sense.
And to bring it full circle, you mentioned how with technology, we often lose a couple of senses in the process. Well, as technology advances, the ultimate
goal them back
is
in.
Give us, well, not just to bring them back in, but give us new senses.
Yes.
The idea of when I'm in a virtual environment and I'm able to shake someone's hand. Okay, now that I can shake someone's hand, if I'm in a game, can I have a superpower and throw things at them with the superpower?
Right.
I could throw things at people in the real world, although I might get in trouble. Right. But what about shooting lightning out of my hands like a superhero in a modern movie? Yeah, and that's a feeling that you'd have that you may not have in real life, or maybe medical purposes. You know, I'm being greedy and thinking about what can I do for me, but there are people who are missing limbs. There's therapeutic options for all of this stuff. I believe there's a term for when someone's missing a limb and they can still
phantom limb syndrome. Yeah.
Phantom limbs. Yes. And I feel like there's probably therapeutic techniques in virtual reality to help people with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it, you know, that's bringing back a sense that they had
lost.
Yes.
And then I remember I shared a story that I had read a long time ago before about, and you mentioned adding new senses, and it brought this back to mind. But there was a gal who, don't try this at home, kids, against her doctor's strenuous advice, sliced open her fingertips and inserted piezoelectric slips of metal into her fingertips, right? Piezoelectric meaning that it generates electricity under certain kinds of stress. So this particular type of metal, I can't remember which one it is, generates an electric field in the presence of a magnetic field, right? Current in presence of a field, sorry. And so whenever she moved her hands in the presence of an electromagnetic field, it would send like electrical current, which her body then parsed and interpreted like, ooh, new hardware installation. And then like invented the firmware, installed it in her head, basically, naturally. It says, this is a new sense. Who'd have thunk it? And just went and just ran with it. And she could feel the contours of electromagnetic fields. She could tell where electronic devices were on or off. She was like a human stud finder. She could just like move her hand on the walls and know where the wires were. She could, and she could feel all of this, right?
Right.
There was one point, one of them eventually got infected because she was experiencing something else, I think. And she had to take them out, but she felt like she had lost another sense. It wasn't that she had just extended her touch. She had added a new sense.
Right.
Right. And so doing these kinds of things using technology, this is something that is within the realm of potential. Like our brains can adapt so well to so many things. It's insane.
Well, and I know a lot of people go to these creepy sci-fi dystopian things when they think right. about this stuff. I know Elon Musk actually wants to be able to connect to people's heads.
Yes.
And it's
everybody goes, oh, no, I'll never be able to get away from the ads.
Right. And it sounds creepy, but what you just talked about, this ability, I'm sitting here, I'm trying to fix the wiring in my house right now. And I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, that would be so useful at such a practical level.
Yes.
So it doesn't have to always be this scary thing. Just think about these
like very contact lenses that let you see infrared. So you can immediately see which burners in your stove are too hot.
Or you don't burn yourself. Optimize the heating in your house,
right?
Being
there's
able
a cold
to
there, you know,
yeah, there are entire companies, that's their whole business plan, is help you to see where it gets cold quickest in your house and build new insulation.
Yeah.
Well, if you've got a pair of contact lenses where you can just look and go, oh, there's a crack in my window and it's letting in cold air, suddenly that's an innovation that saves a ton of money for people in general.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's the coolest stuff.
These things are coming faster and faster. These kinds of fundamental ways we act and track, like on the most basic levels of what we think of as being human, as the senses that we use to interact with the world, right? And they're changing faster and faster. And so we've had, you know, we mentioned writing, we mentioned the printing press, you know, separated by thousands of years, right? Mm-hmm. And then we've gone through successive revolutions of innovation. And this, even possibly more so than the change of each revolution, the fact that they're happening so fast is itself transformative in our society and is a challenge that we have to face and address. Because of these quantum leaps that are conceptual technological leaps that we have to grapple with each one, but then how do we grapple with all of them at once is yet another challenge.
Absolutely. I think that's why we keep coming back to gaming, in part, is because it's an easy way to adapt to these new ideas and to test them. A bad game isn't going to hurt anybody.
Right.
But it will get a bad review, and then the next developer, the next game maker, will take that information and run with it. And you don't have to worry about, maybe aside from people getting occasionally sick in virtual reality, you don't have to worry about that. So I think that's why it's why we keep coming back to gaming too.
Are such a fundamental part of human culture and always have been for so long. And I think there's something that the rise of the gaming culture, I think, is directly tied to a lot of this loss of sense in many ways, because like food is the other huge way that cultures have been defined for millennia. The way we connect to each other authentically is through eating together. And has been. This is how religion is defined. This is how nations are defined by their cuisines. And all I can go to a whole other thing on just how important food is in context of relation and connection. But we can't really eat together anymore the same way. Right.
Yeah.
You can kind of, if people are trying different ways.
We have our happy hours on Zoom right now.
Right, right. It's not quite the same.
You can't smell their food. You can't.
Exactly. Yeah. These senses are not engaging, right? And so there's this huge challenge, but the other big part that defines culture and nations and things is games, and have been for so long. But games translate very nicely to the digital world. And I think they've become the surrogate for all the rest of the things that we've lost in the digital world for now, until we bring them back in again. And they've become center place in many ways, I think.
Well, I don't know a better way to put it, but it kind of belies the fact that you got to look to those people who are going to be using those games. I think the people who will tell us what innovations work and what innovations don't are going to be the youngest people, the kids and the people who dive into these games.
The digital natives.
Exactly. When I was younger, I'm part of what's called the Oregon Trail Generation, excuse me, got to pronounce that right. which is Xennials, which is the segue of between Gen X and the millennial generation. And all that really means is it's the people who were born without the internet, but then transitioned into it during their formative years. So in my teen years, I was tapping away at a computer, figuring all this stuff out. And I was unafraid to do that. I wasn't afraid to break it because I didn't know any better. And my parents, when they would use these devices, they'd be so scared to break them. And I remember that because it occurred to me would inhibit the adoption of these things.
It goes back to the ergonomics.
Exactly.
Being safety to play.
Yep. And I think providing that safe environment is how we adopt these new technologies and how we find what works and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. I think that there's going to be a generation that is so comfortable in VR, and I'm not that generation. Just like I was the generation that was really comfortable getting on the internet and introducing that to my parents, I have to look to the next generation to say, what's comfortable? What do you like? And then work with them to adopt that. And I think that plays into my professional career as well. As I develop websites and as I build tools and apps, I have to look at what works and what doesn't in that very practical way. We call it testing, obviously. But with games and with younger generations, I don't have to worry about creating a piece of software that's going to fail. I can just see what works and what doesn't. And I can take on these new projects and have fun at home, try to build a VR environment of my own. And, you know, that's something I want to do, of course, because
as long as you don't, you know, tell the story about the dangers of VR. And
right. So we talk about creating a safe environment.
Yes.
And in VR, that's a big order.
We have to refigure that out again.
Absolutely. And in fact, I can point out this room here is set up with that in mind, very specifically. My desk right here is very much in the corner, flush with my wall. And then behind me, you'll notice it's very open. If I go ahead and move over here, you can see my floor here is very much open.
Nothing to trip over.
It's vacuumed. There's no sharp objects anywhere. Smart. And that's because in a VR experience, you literally can't see the outside world unless you've got some neat feature where you have a camera up here on your foot, on your controller, which I do actually do that as well.
Cool.
But when I'm in a game, I can't do that.
Right.
So I have this room. It's 10 feet by 10 feet, which is a pretty good size for VR. And as I play these games, a great example of something that has to be a safety measure is these little wrist straps. Right. Because if I'm sword fighting and I do a thrust motion, I'm not a sword fighter, obviously, so I don't know the terminology. But if I do that motion and I let go of the controller, I might risk destroying my monitors.
Right.
And you can look up examples of this all over the internet where you just search, didn't wear the wrist strap or accidentally threw the controller, where people will be playing these games for the first time and they won't realize that if they don't put on the wrist strap, they run this risk of accidentally letting go of a controller. Maybe they're throwing a grenade and they get a little too into it and actually throw the device they're holding.
Or the sense of almost a disconnect, in a sense. You're talking about the disconnect between the physical world and the virtual world. And then there's people who have a fear of heights, and you can simulate a cliff in the virtual world, and they suddenly realize that they could jump off and it's not real. And so then they jump and run into the wall.
And there are indeed videos of those type of things online. Yeah. Someone face planting into a TV in front of them, and then the TV falling off the wall, right. And suddenly $1,000 device is just thrown away because of that. So mitigating, yeah, absolutely.
I don't think that'd be very therapeutic for your fights and trauma, unfortunately.
Well, and bringing up ergonomics, you'll notice that the shelves behind me, they're about 3 feet high. Mm. That's because in my original VR setup, I had shelves that went all the way to the ceiling, and I'd swing my arm around and whack my hand against one of those shelves, thereby knocking down a bunch of books, knocking down action figures, and hurting my hand. I've definitely cut my hand more than once doing that. So when I set up this office, I took that lesson to heart. Nothing is higher than 3 feet high. And that's because I could then swing my arms around without fear of hitting them. And it's also just about how high my hands fall when I let them at rest. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of an ergonomic control that I have in this room. Mm-hmm. Again, the stuff on the walls, they're flush. I got pictures and my TV over there.
And the pictures are higher than you reach.
Yep. And that light up there is the profile's very high and close to the ceiling for the same reason.
Yep.
If I had a hanging
whack lamp, a light bulb.
Yeah. I got a lamp in the other room that if I were to try to play VR in there, I'd be hitting my head on the lamp. I already hit my head on the lamp. VR. Yeah. And so you got to be aware of yourself, your environment.
Yeah.
Those are limitations that we're still dealing with right now. Some games, you just play them seated so that you don't have to run around the room and have to deal with that.
Right, right.
Different developers are going to come up with different solutions. And my personal favorite right now is I have an outline in my entire room when I'm in game. If I go into VR and I'm in game, I get little green outlines of everything in this room. Even photos on the wall, I can see the photos, my pictures on the wall when I'm in VR as like a semi-translucent layer behind it.
Which is kind of like a reversal going back again to the touch screens, where in the touch screen, you have something physical and you're trying to simulate the virtual in the physical.
Yep.
And in this one, it's the reverse. You have the virtual and you're trying to simulate the real, the physical in the virtual and bringing it over from the other side, which is a fascinating reversal.
Well, and we couldn't even do that 10 years ago. In VR's infancy, the hardware just wasn't there. It wasn't strong enough to render both the outside world and inside world in your VR. That rendering two different worlds is a ton of processing power, of programming resources. I've done some of this programming with some open source tools, and I've actually done my own homebrew VR in the past. And triangulating the position of things is hard. You could be good at math and still recognize that it's not easy to cross-reference multiple points from cameras and then figure out where they are in physical space. That's a very daunting task for anyone, even a fully skilled programmer. And so then being able to make that code, having the hardware to make that code, and then not having to worry about it, so that then you can start thinking about things like how tall things are.
Right, right.
Like where you are in the room, what you want to happen in the room. Being able to pick up a little box in a 3D world, there are so many steps just to get to that point where you don't have to think about it, that people don't think about. And that's the kind of stuff I like to think about, which is why I love talking about this with you.
Right, right, right. And thinking about like a programmer. But so let's take a look and kind of zoom back again a bit, because we've got all of these huge changes. We've talked about the touch screen. We've talked about and how this is accelerating. We've talked about virtual reality, augmented reality, these different kinds of things. But how do we relate to them? We've talked about safety, opportunities to play, and how games can help serve this and drive this and provide opportunities to innovate, and not just innovate in the technology, but innovate in ourselves, I think is another thing to explore here. How do we develop the maturity, which is kind of part of the theme of this podcast? How do we change ourselves to be able to take advantage well of these huge conceptual leaps and technological leaps as they're coming faster and faster?
I think there's two answers to that. One I glossed on earlier, which is looking at the next generation and what they're interested in, the things that they most comfortably use, not just games, but tools, will be the things that we want to use, the things that we're most comfortable with. Let me take it a step back, less conceptual. Let's talk about a very literal example. And it plays into my second aspect. In addition to looking at to the younger generations, also finding and sharing the things that are helpful to your lived experience. Now, a very fundamental one is IKEA. This is out of left field, yes. The IKEA app for a phone lets you take a picture of your room and place furniture in the room.
Right.
I would love something like that virtual, so that as I want to plan and improve the different rooms in my house, I can create this room and place different furniture. Taking that and extrapolating that even a step further, I have a basement. Maybe, and on the West Coast, in the Pacific Northwest where I live, that is a pain in the butt sometimes. And what I mean by that is the basement, sometimes water seeps through the cracks, especially during a huge storm. And as a new homeowner, I'm constantly thinking about that because I'm so scared of the basement flooding. And we've had plumbers, we've had experts come in and do sump analysis for our sump pumps, get us a better sump pump setup and recommendations, all of that good stuff. Something that very much I've been thinking about is I would love to be able to pop on my headset and actually look at the aquifer below my house. I want to see the layout of the water and the environment in my home. And tools that are that practical, that useful, and would allow me to save money and help other people save money in the neighborhood by knowing where water is going to seep and water is going to move is a very real and practical example. If I go to one of my neighbors and I'm just casually talking with them and I say, oh, by the way, I figured out where my basement water is flowing in and I can tell you where yours is flowing in, I bet we could save you a ton of money on bringing experts in and doing this maintenance just by providing that information up front and without having to do extra analysis. If I can say to someone, I can
save— You just put goggles on and look.
Yeah. And if I can say to someone, you're going to save $5,000 of work and labor if you know where this is, because suddenly you just got to put better gutters over here in the corner of your house.
Mm-hmm.
Not only are people going to adopt that, they're going to be enthusiastically adopting it. Tell them how you can save money. Tell them what is most comfortable and share that with other people. And that's how we push adoption. That's how we push the envelope. And if you speak to the
benefits, not the features, which is classic marketing.
Precisely. Yes, exactly. I like to think that that's the best way to solve any problem is just market it appropriately and show where you can save money. I think that beyond gaming, because a lot of people think gaming is kind of a joke. And I hate saying that. I don't like saying that, but it's true. And that's because the only benefit of gaming for a lot of people is just the pleasure of gaming, which—
Recreation.
I think time enjoyed is not time wasted in that sense.
Agreed, absolutely.
But you can turn it around and tell those same people, and I've had this experience in real life many times over as a programmer, I'll turn around and say, yeah, but what about this $5,000 I can save you? Suddenly, that technology that they're like, oh, this isn't that impressive. Oh, I can save money? Okay, let's have that conversation. And then you pop the headset on them and they say, yeah, but if I move, everything gets all janky and wobbly and weird. And they'll give you that feedback. They'll tell you how to improve it at that point. Because once they're saving money, they want to get involved.
Right.
So I think that, I think between the marketing and showing how it can save money and resources, and then also watching the future generation, that's how we're going to push the envelope of technology. The younger people are going to teach us what works, and the older people are going to tell us what they really care about, what they want to see happen.
And in both those cases, it's deep intentional listening.
Yes.
Right. Absolutely. And it really comes down to, you said it in our pre-show as one of your mantras for programming is find a need, fill a need.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
All these conceptual leaps are typically where there was a need and somebody found a completely new way of approaching that need that resulted in a new kind of solution, like the invention of the mouse and the cursor. There's a conceptual leap that says hitherto unknown or unthought of, you know.
Well, folks won't even necessarily all agree that those leaps are a big deal.
Until after.
Yeah, there's the apocryphal story of Steve Jobs stealing the mouse from Xerox. Right. So it was a lot more complicated than that. But something as simple as the mouse, Xerox, they didn't market it well. It wasn't. It was on a clunky machine, so people didn't like using it. And then Steve Jobs went there, I believe it's called PARC, P-A-R-C. It's a research center, and saw it. And he was literally jumping up and down saying, why aren't you using this? Why aren't you marketing it?
He saw the potential.
Yeah. And so that opportunity was lost for Xerox, and Apple owned the computer market for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And now we have when you think of a mobile device, some people, if they don't know the difference between them, will just go, oh, you mean my iPod or my iPhone?
Right.
And to the point where an Android device will get referred to as an iPhone by certain people who don't know any better. Right. So obviously Apple has made some really smart decisions about adopting things, and being able to get up front of that and recognize it. Mm-hmm. And like you said, to listen and to be mindful of what you're working with and who you're working with.
Yeah.
It makes all the difference. And you know, you could even get rich doing it if you're making the good decisions.
You can execute on those ideas. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. I really like that though, of focusing on listening to people's needs. I think that's a really good place to, because that's where, you know, good ergonomics comes from. That's where, and we realize that those needs are human needs, and being able to recognize who we are as humans and all these different ways that we need and all these things that we need in order to connect authentically, you know, through the feedback, the interaction, and all these different elements of our humanity. And then seeing that and then conceiving of other ways that we can meet the need of connection, you know, through other senses and through other means of communication, other mediums, and push that envelope with an authentic way of connecting as humans. I think that's a really good way to wrap this up.
I agree. I think using connection to help build connection and improve our connection, yeah. I think it's all totally interrelated. And I think that's a great endpoint. Yes.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, John, for coming in here and talking about this and sharing some of your expertise and your experiences. I'm really excited to get into VR and AR. I haven't actually gotten to it as much myself. I just haven't made the time yet, but it's something that I'm really excited about, and I love the future of it. And I look forward to working with you in future episodes. I'm sure we have plenty more things to discuss.
I hope so.
Thank you again so much for taking the time on this.
And thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'll see you at Nerdmasters. Later.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you had your curiosity sparked to explore these subjects with greater awareness or gained a valuable insight along the way. Take a look at the show notes for links to John's LinkedIn and to Nerdmasters, where we met up and chatted a bit. Leave reviews wherever you can, and make sure to join the conversation on my Discord server. Again, links in the show notes. Community is the catalyst that drives lasting transformation, after all. I'll see you in the next episode of Catalytic Curiosity.